Hey, Jono.
Hey, Werner.
Good to catch up with you again, mate.
Always.
This week, we're launching our show with Dan McCrone,
yep.
Or like I refer to him as McCrone. Actually, an old veteran in UX space. I think you'll probably hate me for saying that he's an old veteran, but he's been involved in UX for about 18 years. Awesome interview with him, once again, from the recent Product Development Days event.
Yeah, awesome guy. Definitely have strong point of views. I mean, one of the points that was very interesting for me was his vision of what should be a good designer. And I think that anybody who is now working in design or want to have a crack at the car of a designer should listen to that interview.
Yeah, I agree. And his strong opinions about ninjas and unicorns, which I agree with, by the way. And then also, we had some interesting conversation around the parallels between product development and theater. So today, we're going to learn about what makes that perfect user experience designer. Without further ado, here's Dan.
Dan McCrone. We're sitting here at Product Development Days. Can you give us a little bit of a background of where you come from? What makes you so famous?
I don't know about famous, but my background is in strategy and user experience, working on a lot of products in media entertainment in America. So most notably for like the New York Times, CNN, the Wall Street Journal, visual strategy and design for Hulu, and then other kind of social media and startup things like Foursquare and The Runway, LearnVest. I think if there's an industry out there at this point, I've probably touched it one way or another, for better or worse, through myself and my team, not just me, to be fair.
And your company's name again?
Charming Robot.
How did you come up with that name?
So I used to own a company called Hard Candy Shell, and one of the things that we were known for better or worse, was being a bit brazen. And when I sold my shares back to my partner, I wanted to create something that had a little bit more heart to it. And so my current business partner and I were brainstorming names, and as we were kind of coming up with the idea, we wanted something that kind of had a little bit of that emotional kind of side to it, as well as the science side of it. So robot being scientific and charming being a little bit more on the empathetic and I think human side of things.
How old is the business now?
About 6.5 years.
That's great, man.
Yeah, I think that to be good at this, to stay good at it, relevant at it, you have to be willing to abandon whatever you did yesterday. I was saying in my workshop yesterday here, you know, we're only as good as the last thing that we did. And so it's funny, I just went through these credits of things I've worked on. I think that while I'm proud of that work, it's also like, who cares? That was 8 years ago or 10 years ago or 5 years ago. And with all the way that technology is evolving, you know, not just within apps or phones or whatever, but into VR and AR and AI, like, we have to keep our finger on the pulse of that to be relevant and to keep our clients, you know, creating things that are going to be good for their audiences as well.
Artificial intelligence, for example, has been mentioned a lot. How does that kind of stuff affect user experience design?
Well, one of my favorite things about designing, and I'm early in this, at least for me, about for AI, is the idea of UX without UI. So how do you design something that isn't design? And I've thought a lot about this, and we're working on a couple projects right now that are in that space, and it's really about understanding dialogue. And so I read this article about, and I talked to this guy who runs this company called X.AI on my podcast, and they're kind of trying to redefine meetings and how you organize meetings. And one of the things we talked about was what expertise you need to bring to the table to really create smart, consumable, or I guess relatable AI. And I think it comes from like a humanities background. So like my background, in addition to doing UX and strategy for longer than the internet should know, is you know, I have this theater background. And one of the things this guy, Dennis Mortensen, and I were talking about was the fact that, like, using playwrights and using people who understand how to not just tell stories but create characters helps AI become a much bigger reality than just the engineering of it. So there really, I mean, coming back to the company name of Charming Robot, like, there really is a science and art to it, because you can't have one without the other with AI. There needs to be a real connection between a person and whether it's an Alexa or anything else that's using intelligence to create a relationship.
Do you see in the field like other interesting experiences or influences coming in?
From theater?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've had this theory, I guess it's a theory, for like the past, I don't know, 16, 17 years. And I actually wrote about this in Forbes last year, about how the product creation process and the theater creation process are the exact same thing. And what I mean by that is that in theater, you can't put on a production without a director and a stage manager and a set designer and a lighting designer and a costume designer and actors and a writer. And so, I mean, sometimes those roles might double up, right? Much like it might in a startup, you have to wear multiple hats, but you can't do it alone. And not only that, but you also have to respect what each of those roles bring to the table. A lighting designer who doesn't understand how a set designer is using color can completely wash out what the purpose is,
right?
The same thing is true in the world of product development. If UX and visual design and development aren't talking to each other, or content strategy or whatever, aren't talking to each other so that they are collaborating to make the best product possible, everything will fall apart. I think if you look at old waterfall processes, you see decisions that are made in UX being canceled out in design and then being canceled out again in development because no one thought to understand what made those choices right in each of those, pieces of the process. But the other thing is that there's knowledge sharing, right? So in theater, when you're talking to a set designer and a lighting designer, a costume designer, like, they're kind of sharing theory together and making sure that the decisions they make complement each other.
Yeah.
In product design, you want to have a designer and a UX person and a developer talking to each other. And there are other roles too. I'm just using these three examples. Yeah. Talking to each other because the developer might have a suggestion for you in UX that you would never have thought of because of their perspective of things that they've experienced. This has happened with us in like checkout systems.
Yeah.
You know, we like want to create the best checkout process in the world and we think we've nailed it. And the developer's like, oh yeah, I've seen that before. It doesn't work well because of this, this, and this. But here's something else we saw. What do you guys think about improving on that? And all of a sudden, they've challenged you to become smarter and to make a better decision. And so that to me is the best parallel I can think of because it lets everyone respect each other's roles, respect the expertise we all bring to the table, and in my mind, in the end, create better products because of it.
In UX, you speak about a user. The thing that I like about your theater analogy is that would you also then refer to the users as an audience? Because an audience is different than users.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think that in the end, you're talking about people. You know, whether you're watching a show or you're an interactive theater experience or you're consuming a commercial or you're using a product, like, you're still a person. And this is the thing I think we always forget in design, whether it be in advertising or theater, is that we're all people. And you're actually looking to make an emotional connection with whatever you're making, you know? I think if you look at the definition of brand, it's the emotional connection that a person has with the thing that they're connecting with. And so I think we're just using different terms for the same type of person.
I'll tell you why I said that. You can get applause or you can be hit by tomatoes. But I mean, but in the way that you describe, I do agree.
Look at it this way, though. If you're an advertiser, let's use Nike. I use this example a lot when I give talks. So if you're looking at the traditional world of marketing and advertising, and I don't work in that world anymore, but I think of it this way. They have $100 million they can spend to get in front of an audience, and I use that in quotes. But that audience is also the user of their product. They use the sneakers or the shirts. Now, the difference is this, is that Nike can spend all this money to attract an audience saying, if you buy this product, you are going to be the better athlete because you're using Nike. Whereas if I create a product on the internet and you download my app that I made, well, it doesn't matter how much advertising I used. Within 10 seconds, either it's going to work for you or it's not. With Nike, you buy the shoe, you feel better about it. That shoe could be the wrong shoe for you. It doesn't matter. You know what I mean? You could be destroying your foot when trying to run on it. Yeah. But it doesn't matter because you're the odd. You know what I mean? I think if you separate it that way, you know, that's historically, you're probably right. But I think they converge more and more now because people are becoming smarter.
Yeah.
So that $100 million ad campaign about buying the right sneaker, you know, if that sneaker sucks, you're probably going to know it more quickly than you ever did before because you might do some more research and you can...
Exactly.
There's more, I think, content inputs to... than just the advertiser, than that to educate you. And so you have to be thinking about it as a person using the product, not just as a audience, you know, passively watching a commercial and being brainwashed to buy something. You know,
come on, you need that other credit card.
Absolutely.
So you said something very interesting about roles, that you wanted to have those UX designers, those developers working together, inspiring together, having those external influence. I guess that one of your main challenges is to create those teams. So can you give some insight about how do you choose people? How do you... And I know also that you have strong feelings about ninjas.
To your point about ninjas, and I do have very strong feelings that you can read about on the internet as to why you shouldn't be looking for.
About that one.
I have a anyways.
I should have gone there.
There's an article I think up on Medium called "Unicorns Do Not Exist" that that sums up my feelings on that. But basically, you know, I used to be, when I started working in the industry, you could know everything. You could be a developer and a designer and a UX, and we didn't even have names for half this stuff. But as technology has broadened, right, and as the variety of audiences has increased, you know, having one person who knows how to do everything is unrealistic.
Yeah.
Years ago, about 10 years ago, maybe a little more than that, I used to believe that the people who did UX should also be the front-end developers of things, so that you kind of had to own two sides of the project. But I totally don't agree with that anymore either. I changed my thinking because, again, front-end development means something different for the web versus a mobile app. And even a mobile app could be iOS or Android, or if you're one of the few people who uses a Microsoft phone, I'm sorry. But I think for now, you know, it's about, I look for people who have an understanding of the other disciplines. So if I'm hiring a UX person, or experience designer, I guess is a better way of calling them, or product designer now, I want someone who really understands, like, at their core, strategy, business strategy, user engagement strategy, and interaction understanding. But I want them to understand theory of design and how things interplay, and I want them to understand technology. And if I had my druthers, they understand the internet. And a lot of people don't understand the internet. They know that they don't understand, like, how the internet works. And, like, I found myself about 10 years ago on a research trip with a friend of mine who's a really good UX designer, and he really wanted to, he was new to UX at the time, and he really wanted to be a great UX designer, but he had no concept of the internet and how it worked. And I think if you have some historical knowledge of that, you really can become a better designer. So I look for people who have a passion and a thirst for that kind of that knowledge, as well as in UX, at least, like, that kind of core based strategy that I talked about. In visual design, it's somewhat different, right? You want them to have an understanding of UX, but a focus on, you know, design theory and how to apply that to the kinds of things we're putting together. Development, I mean, I'm not a person to hire a developer. I wouldn't be the right person to interview that person, but I would want a developer to have respect for design and UX, but also bring it, you know, a real good, strong sense of technology and what can work and what can't work to the table.
So what's the main flow you see in people coming to you? They come to you, they say, I want to be a product designer, I want to be a designer, and you're like, I might not select you. What do you tell them?
I think I don't know how anyone else feels about this in the world of UX, or I don't know how most people feel. I know I have very strong feelings on what makes a good UX designer, and, you know, I think everyone would always agree that empathy is a good thing, but I think it's about storytelling. I think that, you know, we can go back to talking about theater, or I would actually broaden that to humanities. People with humanities backgrounds, in my opinion, make the best UX designers, whether you're theater or dance or art in some way, or literature, history, philosophy, you understand how to tell a story, how to craft a story, or narratives might be a better phrase or word, because you have to take all these pieces of information and sort them together into something that's going to make sense to someone. That doesn't always make sense to someone who's really strong, let's say, in logic and math, because not all flows are logical. As humans, we make choices that don't always make sense, and so there's a lot of psychology to what we do. And so I look for those kind of backgrounds, and then communication skills. Like, you really have to know not just how to communicate your thoughts via design, but also in a conversation, you know, whether it be with a client or with a team, you know. And I mean that, like, internally, I want someone to be able to communicate, you know, with us just as much as I want someone to be able to communicate with a client. And the last thing I would say is, and this is part of communication, is having an opinion. It doesn't have to always be right. In fact, oftentimes there is no right answer, but you have to have an opinion, because I want people who will challenge me. Like, I don't want a team of people who are yes men, because I'm not a yes man or yes person. I want someone who's going to say, Dan, that's an interesting idea, but I don't agree with this. This happens to me all the time with my team. Like, they'll be like, I don't know about that. And we'll go back and forth. And much like I mentioned with the developers earlier, being able to challenge each other makes you, I think, more creative and create stronger and better choices, even sometimes that surprise yourself. So I want someone like that who is willing to challenge, but also understanding how that works and how you compromise and how you collaborate to compromise.
I like your comment around compromise, because I think with compromise you can move forward, right?
Yeah, I think that's one of the hardest things to do as you grow through your career. I've probably told you this story before, but like when I was early in my career, one of my big clients was General Electric in their financial wing. And I was an arrogant 22-year-old who thought and this is like 1999, so like I thought I knew everything about the internet because no one else had worked in it. You know, we were all new to it, rather, not just no one else had worked in it. Anyways, I got into this fight with a client, and it was about the design of a forum. And think about forums in 1999, there wasn't much you could really do, and there weren't really much, innovation going on there. There's like, you know, there are only certain things you can do. But anyways, we got into this fight. She wanted me to copy the UX of another forum that she really liked, and she was pretty savvy. So like, you know, she wasn't coming at it from no knowledge. And I disagreed with her. I was like, no, that's crap. Like, this is the way to go. This is the new innovative design for forums. And we got into it. We went into a screaming match in the middle of the floor of my the company I worked for. And GE at the time was the company I worked for's biggest client, and the project I was on was the biggest project by the biggest client. And I get into this fight. And my project manager, who's become a great friend of mine over the years, my boss at the time, says to me, pulls me aside, he's like, he's probably like 10 or 15 years older than me, and he's like, listen, clearly you're passionate about this, but you can't get into these fights, you can't get into a fight with a client like that, you can't do that, but you need to find another way. And what I've learned from that, you know, in the past 18 years is that there are battles you pick, and there are battles you don't. And when you don't agree, you either try to get to the middle of that to find a better solution, or you use negotiation techniques to get around it. But I think that as we mature, and I think this is true of anyone who's young in their career, I use my arrogant self as an example, but I think that I've watched this with team members that I've had, where like you take a lot of emotion into what you do, and without realizing that this isn't an emotional thing. You can't get attached to one idea. You have to navigate your way through those conversations to find the best thing that's going to work for the user and for the person whose vision it is you're designing for. And those may not always match up. Oftentimes, they're square pegs and round holes. Mm-hmm. So compromise is sometimes the best thing you're going to get. And by the way, that's probably sometimes better for the product, because just because you have a great innovative idea, my forum idea was pretty awesome, I will say.
We'll post a link to it.
but at the time, you know... she was right, I think, in the end. Because while I wanted to design a new system, the internet was still fairly new to people, so this was a system maybe they already knew. So just trying to introduce something brand new and innovative, even if it was a better, in the long run, idea, may not have been the right idea at the time, because why teach something new when they can already be familiar with something and use it?
Does it shift the needle for the business?
Right.
And that element of design might not be important for the user, and it might not even make a impact for the business as well.
Well, yeah, and you know, going back to your question earlier about audience, oftentimes our clients, we don't want to acknowledge this sometimes, but our clients are experts in who their audience is. And sometimes they're not. Sometimes they think much more of their brand than they really are. But, you know, if you're spending all your time with a particular audience or set of people, and even though, like, I know from lots of research that I could do this, and this for a solution, maybe you're right, because you know that your audience has these habits, and so that is important to keep in mind. And maybe it doesn't. Maybe like my idea might be trying to push the business needle 10 times farther than A, you need it to be, and B, it's ready to be pushed at this point.
Yeah, and then there's something else, right? So we wanted to try and do something special for you, so we brought you into a little dodgy corner. We tried to go for between two ferns, but we failed.
It's between one ficus, I don't know what that is, and snow in the background, so it's isolating.
Snow for you, right? And I think when it comes to setting up a podcast or a conversation, you're much better at it than us at the moment. So let's talk a little bit. You've got a podcast going with an interesting kind of twist to it.
Sure. It's called Story in a Bottle. Is the twist that we drink a lot during it?
I think we should start doing that.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. No, I mean, everyone should. I think it makes people I was going to say it makes people loose-lipped. My thought on it was this, is that I really enjoy conversations and I really understanding how people kind of got to where they are. But I don't want it to feel like an interview. I want it to be a conversation. And so my whole idea was like, let's have a drink. Let's get to know each other. And especially now when most of the people I talked to were strangers. When I first started, it was people I knew. So getting to know someone over whiskey or whatever their cocktail of choice is, and I drink what they drink. So certainly I've had some drinks that I haven't enjoyed. I will say in the beginning also it spun a little bit out of control. I think the first like 50 or 60 episodes, there's some in there where we drank a little more than we should have, and there are some edits that needed to happen because of that. But now, you know, we do it. I own a bar in Manhattan called Fool's Gold. And so now we do it there, and it's a little bit more tame. But it is still, it's literally a bar conversation. We're sitting at a bar with a couple of mics and drinks. And it's been really fascinating to get to know, you know, the different ways people have entered into their tech or media careers. I think we've expanded a little bit more into entertainment now. But, you know, it's such a diverse set of paths people take. And it's wonderful to see that we can kind of get to where we are here today from 20 different ways, but then seeing the parallels that people have too. I talked to a lot of entrepreneurs who, when we reach deep back into their childhoods, we all have like these weird similarities where when we were like 10 years old, we started our first companies, you know. Like I met people who like are in media too. Like I've met a bunch of people who started like their neighborhood newspaper when they were like 10 and like peddled it around there to the different houses in the neighborhood. And these roots of entrepreneurship or journalism or whatever are so fascinating that they're a part of us even before we've discovered that
it's like in the DNA.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I love that. I love that, like, and also it makes me feel not alone, because I was a kid in elementary school. My friends and I started a greeting card business, and then another kid in school started a bookmark like making business.
Yeah.
And then we acquired him. I didn't want competition. I wanted to expand our product line. I mean, whatever. And I remember talking to some people on my podcast about this, and they're like, oh my God, I did something very similar, and you know, I leveraged my artistic talents to do this. And I'm like, oh God, it's so great to know that I wasn't this weird fluke, you know, freak of nature. That's been fun. And we've done about, I don't know, like 170 something episodes now.
Respect. Yeah. Well, we'll post a link to that as well. Poland, right? So you've been here a few times.
I have, yeah.
And we met the first time about 2 years ago. But then you've also come and gone a few times.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen a change?
My experience in Poland has been, it's evolved. I don't know that I could say that I've seen a change in culture, because I only get to experience it here like 2 to 3 days at a time.
Yeah,
My experience in Poland is different because my relationship to the people that I know here has changed. So knowing you for a couple of years and knowing a bunch of our friends and colleagues for even more than that, I feel a comfort level here that I didn't feel the first time I came here. And I think that's because, like, I can come here to this conference, which is not the one that we met at, you know that I'm going to find 5 or 10 people that I know. And so, like, we've hung out the past few nights, and being able to come from, you know, 5,000 miles away and land somewhere and be a part of a community. And the community isn't just Poland. It's all of kind of, I guess it's kind of Eastern Europe in general.
Yeah.
Is kind of really a cool thing. And it's partly because of the internet, I guess, because we're meeting because of the internet, but also because we can stay connected via Facebook or whatever. Like, that's amazing to me. And knowing that it wouldn't just be in Poland. Like, our friend Yuri lives in Belarus, and he and I were talking about, like, meeting up there next year for another conference. You know, we have friends in Berlin and friends in Warsaw and all, and it's just kind of like the best thing in the world to know there's a whole other community outside of New York Tech, which is like my day-to-day life, that I can be a part of, that's to me is very special, that didn't exist in my life 3.5 years ago. I don't know, for me that's the change, and that's not, has nothing to do with the culture in Poland, I guess, but it's something that means a lot to me.
That's great. I was thinking to say maybe you should come open a shop here, but then I thought no. We don't need more competition, but what you could potentially do is come open a bar.
I would much rather open a bar here than a design shop, believe me. I'm I'm passionate about both those things, but bars are more fun sometimes. Well, I think traveling gives you a perspective on the world that you can't get in the little bubble that wherever you might be. You know, I think New York is a pretty multicultural city, which I really do love. But I think we get, especially in New York, I think we get trapped in this world where, you know, you have access to everything at all times, technologically and culinarily, you know. Whereas when you travel to, I did a road trip across the U.S. earlier this year, and that just gave me a perspective on the U.S. that I'd never had, you know, seeing different points of view and different lifestyles within middle America, which oftentimes we on the coast forget about, which is different than from traveling to, I was in Colombia last year and how technology differs there, or like all the different places I've been in the past few years, like you forget that, you know, just because we're a global society, that doesn't mean that we're all living in the same lives. So I don't know if that gives me a perspective on storytelling so much as reality, like the reality that I live in New York City, in like this like boiling pot or melting pot rather of cultures, isn't the rest of the world. And kind of the other side of that is that when I wake up every morning and look at Twitter and realize what a shit show my country has become, you know, that's not as, I mean, that might be important to other people around the world, but everyone has their own stuff they're looking at.
Beyond that, right?
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, when we're designing things, I think we're often not designing for ourselves, you know? And so even just having exposure to things that are not your language or whatever. Actually, this is a good example. We designed something this year that we had designed in 10 different languages. So, and a lot of them were Middle Eastern languages, and that were different alphabets, but also some things read left to right, and some things read right to left. And so just understanding that, like, you're not just designing for someone who's not yourself, you're designing for someone who looks at the world and content or whatever and commerce in a totally different way. And you know, having experienced things in countries that consume things in different ways makes you realize how important it is to consider those. You know, even if you're not you don't necessarily understand what you're looking at on the page.
Exactly. Is that localization? So do you send people into those local areas to go and immerse themselves a little bit in the...
What I was lucky to have a UX designer who has spent a ton of time in Israel, and is actually, her family is Israeli and South African, and so she spent a lot of time traveling the world, and so I made sure that she was like the lead UX person on it, so she could bring that perspective.
Yeah.
This particular client didn't necessarily want to pay for us to travel to the Middle East and go to a bunch of different countries, which probably made sense at the time, but I think while we probably could have done a good job of that without her, I think her perspective made it a better experience for everyone, and I think a better design overall.
Great. So Dan, we thank you for your time. We're going to cut it off here, but we definitely want to line you up for another conversation.
Sure, anytime.
Maybe this time with something in a bottle.
Well, if we're doing in Poland, I feel like we need to do some vodka or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I have not had much vodka here this time, which is weird.
I let you down, sorry. But half our team is also sick, right? I mean, we just lost Jonathan and Yuri. Yuri's been half dying as well, so I'm just glad you're keeping strong. And dude, once again, great to see you here, and thanks for chatting to us.
Let's make it less than 2 years.
Definitely. Too much change in 2 years.
Definitely, man. Good seeing you.
Cheers.